Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll talk about the importance of audible traffic signals for people who are blind or visually impaired. First, protesters came out across Wisconsin this weekend protesting President Trump's zero-tolerance immigration policy. Organizers expected rallies in more than 20 cities across the state, and more than 600 were planned in every state across the country. They were called Families Belong Together, and they protested President Trump's recently ended policy of separating families at the U.S.-Mexico border, those who were accused of entering the country illegally. Jonathan Anderson is a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Green Bay, and he was covering the protests there on Saturday. Jonathan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what was the scene like in Green Bay on Saturday?
The scene in Green Bay was a protest along the city's riverfront downtown. There were, we're told, around 700 people who came out in support of the protest. They chanted, they held signs, and they marched around a city block. And they were very vocal in their opposition to separating children from their parents.
And how would you describe the mood of those protesters?
Well, I mean, I think that they were very serious. There's certainly, to the best of my knowledge, there was no, you know, any sort of violence or anything like that. But they were, I think they were very passionate about this issue. They see it as a human rights issue, that it's in their view, a deep injustice that's happening to people at a human level beyond sort of politics or beyond, you know, the legal question of it.
How would you gauge the size and kind of energy of this gathering on Saturday in Green Bay to other protests or rallies in Green Bay?
You know, I think it's a hard question for me to answer. I think it was fairly significant. I believe it was substantially more than what the organizers were expecting. But, I mean, it was probably among some of the largest in the state, except for probably Milwaukee and Madison, which is fairly consistent given their populations.
And who was there? Were there members of Green Bay's immigrant community? Were there members of faith communities? Who was there? Who attended?
Yeah, it was a lot of those people, and it was people from around the region. There were certainly members of the immigrant community, of members from who had, you know, religious roles. There were public officials there as well who you know, opposed this policy. It was a very diverse group.
And what were you hearing from those people who were there marching, showing showing their presence and their support about why they were there?
Sure. I mean, one point clearly was to denounce the Trump administration's zero-tolerance policy of separating migrant children from you know, their parents. And, of course, some also here and elsewhere have called for abolishing ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. So those were two very sort of clear and specific messages. But I also sensed that overall this was sort of a broader and more general protest against the way the federal government under President Trump is treating undocumented immigrants and treating those who are being found at the borders, you know, crossing illegally. But the process should be more humane and that the government should not take such an adversarial posture toward them.
It is interesting because, as we said, Jonathan, the policy of separating families at the border has been stopped. There are, by counts, about 2,000 children who still need to be reunited with their families. But those points that you just made, does that point to why the protesters thought that there was still a need for this action, even though the policy that I think kind of inspired some of the initial action and reaction has actually stopped?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the court has ordered that those families be reunified. But I think you're exactly right. I spoke to one man from Green Bay. His name is Christian Rubio, and he came to the rally with his family, and he said that he was there, of course, to oppose separating migrant families. But he also told me that he took issue with how President Trump has portrayed immigrants, classifying them as criminals and as bad people. Rubio told me that, you know, he's an immigrant himself and is now a citizen, and he's a social worker, and he's a productive member of the community, and he knows other immigrants who are contributing in positive ways to their communities. While the protests were very much motivated by the separation of children from their parents, there were these, you know, deeper and broader motivations for many of those who were demonstrating.
We're talking with Jonathan Anderson right now. He's a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Green Bay, and he covered the protests that happened in Green Bay on Saturday under the heading of Families Belong Together. And Jonathan, a group of young women who are DACA recipients helped organize this event, the Piguero sisters. Here's Merveyas Piguero Almonte talking about why they wanted to be involved.
This community in Green Bay cares, and that's what we want. We want immigrants that are here, no matter your status, to feel like you don't have to hide.
And Jonathan, can you tell us a little more about those sisters and why they decided to help organize the protest?
Sure. I know just a little bit in speaking to some of them. My understanding is they came here from the Dominican Republic, and they've been in Green Bay for around 17 years or so. My understanding is that at least one of them, I imagine all three, are DACA recipients, and they said this was a really important issue for them personally because they're affected by it personally.
And what about other immigrants? You mentioned one gentleman, these sisters. Were there immigrants who might have come under other programs who would not directly have been affected by these policies but wanted to show their solidarity, perhaps?
I imagine that's possible. I did not, to the best of my knowledge, interview anyone who was in that position, but my sense is that there probably were people who were in that position who were protesting as well here and around the state and around the country.
Were there any counter-protesters there?
There were not any in Green Bay that at least I had seen, but there were some elsewhere across the state. We had a report out of Wausau that there were some people who had expressed some disagreement with some of the Families Belong Together actions. In Wausau, as I understand it, the protesters formed a circle in a city square downtown, and they wanted to have a peaceful kind of discussion about this issue. And from one of my colleagues who was reporting in Wausau, there was somebody who sort of entered that circle and attempted to sort of hijack the discussion express disagreement, and that sort of ruffled some feathers. And there was also some people who were just sort of observing the demonstration, and they said that they disagreed with it, but they were just sort of watching it and not participating. I'm also aware of a situation somewhat south of Wausau in Wisconsin Rapids where there was a man who had pulled up in a pickup truck, and he said that separation laws have, quote, been on the books forever, and then he drove away. But that's the extent of counter-protests or counter, I guess, voices that I've heard from this.
And Jonathan, as we wrap up, as we said, the policy of separating families at the border has been stopped. I guess it could, if the administration decided, could restart, although there's now a judgment from a court saying that families need to be reunited. What did the protesters seem to think were their next steps? What do they want to do if they're hoping to keep some kind of momentum going?
Well, you know, one of the things that was very clear in Green Bay, and from what I understand from many other sites of protests around the state, was people were asking their neighbors and their friends were asking people who were at the protests to be involved in politics and to vote. There was a lot of get out the vote efforts at these rallies, and I think that is probably going to be one of the material things that may come out of this.
And we'll leave it there. Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us. Jonathan Anderson's a reporter for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Green Bay. He was with us to talk about immigration protests across the state 2 days ago. Right now, for many people, crossing the street safely doesn't take much more than looking up from a phone and checking both ways to make sure that there's no traffic coming, and if there's a traffic light, that it's in their favor. But for people who are blind or visually impaired, it's another story. A recent article from the UW Journalism Project called The Observatory took a look at audible traffic signals and what they mean for people who are blind and visually impaired. Denise Jess is the executive director of the Wisconsin Council of the Blind and Visually Impaired, based here in Madison. Denise, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Well, you are legally blind, and in the Observatory article, you shared what it's like walking to work each day. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So I am legally blind, which means I have some limited vision. And so walking to work every day is really an exercise in mindfulness, I think I would describe it as. That, you know, getting preoccupied and having my head somewhere else isn't a luxury that I can afford, because I need to practice just acute awareness of my surroundings so that I can safely cross streets and navigate sidewalks. Even though I use a white cane, that's not an assurance that I'm going to get to and from safely. So when I come up to an intersection, whether it's a signalized one or not, and I tend to use signalized intersections because they at least cue the cars that someone is wanting to cross, I can never really fully trust that cars are going to stop. So I am always paying attention to where I hear traffic flow and listening for cars to stop if they are, you know, in the lanes where I would need to be crossing. So there's often, and research shows this is true too for other folks with visual impairment, that we delay our entrance onto the crosswalk because we're just checking so many times, checking, rechecking, is it really safe to cross? And by that time, you know, the light might be starting to flash already, which reduces our safe passage time. So, you know, 2-3 times a day, depending on how many meetings I'm running to and from, you know, that's the process of getting across a street safely. If it's an unfamiliar one and I don't know the traffic pattern, I don't know if there's a left turn lane or a right turn lane. You know, I may wait a light or two cycle mm-hmm. before I cross. So people are looking at me like, "What, lady, are you going to cross?" No, not yet. Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't navigated this enough yet.
So the article in the Observatory focused on audible traffic signals. What exactly are those?
Oh, they're so awesome. Whenever I run across one, I want to do cartwheels right there in the street. They use an audible sound to help pedestrians cross safely. So right outside the WPR studios here, you've got two of them. And there are times when I'm running errands or meetings on campus where I'll intentionally go to those intersections to cross, because as soon as I hit the button for the walk, I get a tactile. It will give a little shake. So I'll know that I've hit the button correctly. And then it will tell me either wait because the traffic is still running and I can't cross, or it will tell me the walk light is on to cross University or park or wherever I am. And that is an amazingly liberating experience to be able to use those audible signals because they're giving me information. You know, a lot of times if you come up to a regular traffic signal and you press the button, if there is a button, you don't know, is it working? Is it not working? There's no feedback loop. So this tactile little shake and then the words wait or the walk sign is on give me the information that I need, and I can actually start proceeding through the intersection sooner. And the research again shows that when audible signals are used, people who are visually impaired start their progression across the street sooner and can actually capitalize on that whole walk light time period.
Let's take a listen to what that sounds like.
Wait. Wait. University. Walk sign is on to cross University. University. Walk sign is on to cross University.
So how common are those audible traffic signals in communities around Wisconsin?
Sadly, they're not very common. The best practice is to install them at the time that a new signal goes in, and that is the most cost-effective. And, you know, if communities truly value inclusion and accessibility for all people, because not only people who are visually impaired benefit from the signals, many other groups do as well. So really forward-thinking communities will say, let's just simply install one right away when we're putting this new signal in. I don't know many communities that do that. And so unfortunately, then things have to get retrofitted later, which is much more costly and usually comes after there's an incident or people are feeling unsafe and having to prove that that's a dangerous intersection.
We're talking with Denise Jess right now. She's the executive director of the Wisconsin Council of the Blind and Visually Impaired. We're talking about how important audible traffic signals can be to people when they are trying to safely cross the street. Denise, do we have a sense how many people in Wisconsin are considered to be blind or visually impaired?
Sure. There are at least 100,000 people in the state of Wisconsin who have significant visual impairment. So that means, you know, anything that is less than 20 over 70 in the good eye. And then there are a percentage of those people like me who are legally blind and other folks who are fully blind. And that ranges from children through our aging adults. And as we know from looking at things like macular degeneration and retinopathy, that our aging adults who may have had normal vision throughout their lives are now also joining the ranks of those of us who are blind and visually impaired. So we'll see those numbers continually increase with the baby boomer population beginning to age. Mm.
Ideally, I think there would be an audible traffic signal at every intersection, but,
yeah,
you know, that doesn't sound like it's realistically going to happen at any time in the future. In lieu of that, are there ways that drivers and pedestrians can kind of be partners in safety at intersections?
Yeah, they really can. So, I know that my colleagues and friends and clients who are visually impaired take street crossing really seriously. Sometimes people will say, well, you should be more careful. we're so hypervigilant about crossing. I don't know anybody that takes that in a cavalier way. So I think understanding that we're putting a lot of effort into crossing safely. For those of us who carry a white cane or use a service animal, that is just a vital universal signal to other pedestrians and to drivers that we don't see you. And in Wisconsin, and actually in all 50 states, there's a white cane law that requires that drivers stop for someone using a white cane, whether, you know, they're in the crosswalk or, mid-block. In Wisconsin, it's within 10 feet of that walker. And it is the driver's responsibility to be paying attention and have an awareness of their surroundings and to make make that stop for someone carrying a white cane. And if we work together, we could have a really good collaboration and people could be much safer.
It does seem really concerning that we're seeing constantly the number of distracted drivers
yes.
going up, not to mention drunk driving and drugged driving, but distractions from phones, from
exactly.
everything else. That has to be really scary for someone who's visually impaired.
It is. You know, when I talk with my colleagues and friends and in my own experience, I can hardly think of a day that has gone by in my life where I didn't have that little extra heartbeat moment. So it's not uncommon with one of the places where I cross going to work in the morning, even though I'm using a signalized intersection for drivers to run that. They get caught in the run the red. So they get caught in the flow of traffic. They're looking at their phone or applying mascara or whatever things people do in their mm-hmm. cars on their way to and from work. And they run the red. And usually it's two or three cars that run. And so, you know, I have to wait until I truly believe it's as safe as possible. Just out of curiosity, the month of February, I decided to keep a tally. So my morning commute, my afternoon commute, how many days was it that I didn't have to deal with a car running the red? In the month of February, with those two times a day crossing my street, there was one day where no one ran the red. And that was stunning and disturbing to me to actually see
wow.
that written down.
Well, Denise, as we wrap up, I know that sometimes people would like to assist someone with a disability, but they're not sure how to. So what I'd like to ask you is, what should sighted people do if they see a person who might be blind or visually impaired trying to cross the street? What's the best offer of help that we can give?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. So really, we want to support the empowerment of that person. So asking them, you know, is there a way that I could be helpful? Or would you like any assistance? And then taking the cue from the person who's blind and visually impaired directly, because in my case, I don't need someone to grab my arm and would prefer not to have that happen. I will just say, will you walk with me? Or will you tell me when the light has changed? Other folks would feel much more comfortable having a sighted guide, so someone that they could take their arm and walk across. Other folks are like, no, I've got it. I'm good to go. So the most empowering thing is to ask, not ignore. I've been at intersections where I've stood next to someone and I've outright asked, would you tell me when the light changes? And they walk away. okay. What do I do with that? Mm-hmm. And then other times where folks have grabbed my arm, let me help you. But the times when I have felt just really empowered is when someone's asked me and I've been able to let them know what would be most supportive.
Well, Denise, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Judith. This has been a delight.
Denise Jess is the executive director of the Wisconsin Council of the Blind and Visually Impaired. She joined us to talk about audible traffic signals and how important they can be for people with a sight disability. First, you may be familiar with the concept of a doula. That's a non-medical support person who stays with an expectant mother through delivery and provides assistance after the birth. They're often a complement to a doctor or a midwife. That type of doula helps usher in a new life. It's not surprising, then, that a different kind of doula could provide support at the other end of a lifetime. Dr. Jackie Yeager is a board-certified physician in the specialties of family medicine and hospice and palliative care. In August 2017, she opened a solo palliative care practice in La Crosse, and as a certified death doula, she provides intensive bedside support for dying patients and for their families. She joins us now from our La Crosse studios. Dr. Yeager, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, and thank you for having me today.
Well, tell us more about what a death doula is and what a death doula does.
Well, for me, there's really no one definition of a death doula. It's an evolving occupation. But for me, it's being a wise guide, someone who's been down this road before, who can then provide really a continuous presence and provide physical, emotional, and informational support to the family and to the person who's dying. I also see a death doula as someone who, at least it's my passion to be an educator and to really help the community learn how to be doulas for each other. I think it's a natural process, and it doesn't require necessarily a professional to manage it, but I think we've gotten so far away from knowing what to do at the time of death that we need a little bit of education out there.
And we will go back to that idea that all of us can kind of take some of those lessons and provide that support to others. But you are a certified death doula. And what does that mean? How does one become certified?
Well, right now, there's no one certifying agency out there. There are a handful of different organizations that provide training, and you can be certified. Now, I was trained in Boulder at the Conscious Dying Institute, and that consisted of two 5-day on-site trainings with a lot of reading and homework assignments in between times. Other programs are even online or maybe a weekend. So it's quite variable. The term, I think eventually we will coalesce into some sort of a certifying body. But right now, it can mean a lot of different things.
And at what point in the end-of-life process does a death doula generally get involved?
Well, ideally, we'd be involved months before the death and do what I call the dying time care plan, where we really sit down and say, you know, where do you want to be spiritually, emotionally, physically, psychologically, and in a practical sense when you die? Where are you in those areas right now, and what are the steps we need to take to get you there? Often, however, I get called in much later in the process, and some doulas really specialize in being called in at the time of death and after death. So it's variable, and I think there's things I can do to help regardless of where people are at, because sometimes you don't have 3 months' notice. Mm-hmm. But the sooner we can start talking about the possibility, and of course we all know we're going to die, so we could all actually have a plan in place and know who's going to do what when that time comes.
So that dying time care plan, it sounds like in a way it's kind of a roadmap for the person who is near the end of their life, for their loved ones, for maybe professionals who are involved in one way or another to know. Is it primarily to know what that person who is actively dying would like, how to respect their wishes?
Yeah, and it's like a birth plan in some ways. We know that when women put together birth plans, they have to understand that things may change, but at least we have some knowledge of what might be just supportive of that person. I had a patient recently, and he was in my palliative care practice, so we knew that day would come, but we didn't really know how soon. But he mentioned one day, I said, well, what kind of music would you want playing? And he said, well, no kumbaya music. I want the Eagles. And so when his family got there and this dying started rather suddenly, it was really grounding, I think, for everybody to just know that that's something we could do right now. And so everybody pulled up music on their phones, and we started playing the music and felt like we were honoring his wishes. So it can be simple things, and they can be planned out elaborately, but it's grounding for everyone.
We're talking with Dr. Jackie Yeager right now. She is a physician. She's also a certified death doula, and she provides services for dying patients and their families in the La Crosse area. And hospice has become much more familiar and accessible in the past few decades. Jackie, how does a death doula differ, or are they really complementary approaches?
Well, I have been involved as the hospice medical director here in La Crosse for 8 years, so I'm really attached to and appreciate the role of the hospice team and work together with them whenever possible. The difference is that because of various funding sources and regulatory processes, the hospice the members don't get to spend as much time at the bedside as they would probably like to. Whereas a doula really kind of, I cancel my appointments as much as I can for that time and really spend hours and hours at the bedside during those last 3, 4, 5 days of life.
And what are you doing when you are next to the bed or, you know, wherever the patient has been made comfortable? What are you doing to support them in this transition? Death is not always a very dramatic process. There are long times where there's kind of not a lot going on. What are you doing as the death doula?
Well, a lot of what I do is give anticipatory guidance and say, okay, and sort of reassure the people that are there that this is the normal process. It is proceeding normally. It's maybe happening a little quicker or a little slower than what you'd expected, and kind of just drawing out what their questions are, what their fears are. And then it's a really good time to tell stories about the patient who's the person who's dying, maybe do some singing. And I've had I had a family recently who there was some, like most families, there was some trouble in the past. And so we used the Ho'oponopono ritual, which is an ancient Hawaiian ritual that basically has been put to music. And I played it with each person going into the room separately. And basically, the ritual just says, I love you, please forgive me, I'm sorry, and thank you, kind of over and over again. And then I followed that up with each person spending some time in the room alone with one of their loved one's favorite songs. And it was so touching because this 20-something-year-old grandson had really been raised by his grandmother and spent a lot of time in the car listening to her music. So he knew the Elvis songs. He knew the words to all kinds of songs you wouldn't expect a 20-something-year-old to know. And so we played those things, and I could hear outside the door him singing to his grandmother. And it was beautiful.
Jackie, you just touched on something that I wanted to make sure that we talked a little about. You know, families can be messy, and relationships can be messy, and just because someone's life is ending doesn't mean that all suddenly gets resolved. And so you're there for the person who is dying. You're also there for their loved ones, but sometimes it must feel like you're walking a tightrope trying to provide support to two different parties who might be coming at it from a very different way.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of what you do as a doula is sort of just bring the families. There's always messy, and we get worse at these times, not better. And so just being that calm, sort of unattached presence in the room, you can model some calmer behaviors and just sort of maybe even speak about the elephant in the room and say, hey, I know there's been some hard times in your past. Tell me more about that. It's my favorite words, tell me more. It can diffuse some situations and let people just vent a little bit, maybe outside the room a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I see so much healing in families. And if I can just sort of point that out during the time, then the families can recognize it too.
Dr. Jackie Yeager is a board-certified physician and a certified death doula practicing in La Crosse. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Does the support that a death doula can provide sound like something you would welcome? If you've gone through the death of a person close to you, what kind of support do you wish you had had? Or maybe someone took on a similar role for you. Tell us how that helped. Call 800-642-1234. 1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Dr. Jackie Yeager. We're talking about her work as a certified death doula. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you have helped a loved one through the dying process, what support did you find most helpful? What questions do you have for Dr. Yeager about what services a death doula can provide and how they fit into other care? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. And Jackie, we had a question from Chris from Adams, and she was wondering how much death doula services cost, and I'm sure there's a range, and whether insurance covers it.
Right now, insurance does not cover these type of services. This is really sort of a new phenomenon. I charge sort of 3 days in advance, and then refund anything that if it ends up being a shorter process. My desire is to not be thinking about how many hours I've been there, or, you know, if she stays another 15 minutes, does that mean we have to pay mm-hmm. another $15? And my charges are probably a little bit more because I'm also bringing my physician services. So I prescribe medications and I dose them and I really keep really close eye on things. The death doulas in general, it's a very wide range of charges. And in fact, some hospices are training volunteers to do some of this kind of work. Hmm. And so there might even be some free services available of this type.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, Jackie, we did a show about green burials, and we talked about how far away we've gotten from how we used to prepare the bodies of our loved ones for burial. How would you describe the process of dying in the U.S. today?
Well, exactly. I mean, in the last century, it's gone back from being something that happened naturally at home to something that happened secretly at the hospital and then whisk off to the morgue and the funeral home. And I think that we've discovered that being more present during the dying and even after the death helps with the grieving process. And so, you know, immediately after the death, I invite families to help me with the bathing, with just sort of a ritual bathing, maybe not an intensive one, but using some essential oils and soapy water, and just really the tactile part of washing your loved one is a very memorable way to say goodbye.
Let's go to the phone, and Jude is in Nisida. Hi, Jude.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good. What would you like to share?
Actually, my mother passed away about a year and a half ago. We had some issues with her being in the local nursing home because I'm here in Nisida. And it was very difficult, but they actually kind of kicked us out because they wanted her to go through palliative care. And I guess your guest speaker was talking about that. And all of this stuff was completely new to me. I had no idea what I was walking into. So, yes, what your guest speaker is talking about is it would be a wise idea for the listeners to sit down and actually wrap your head around all of this, because it is quite difficult. It's very emotional. We do have family problems. So it was basically my brother and myself that really carried the brunt end of the burden. And when I walked into this, I was like, I had no idea. We ended up going to Otoma Hospice. They were brilliant. They really helped me understand a lot of things that I don't know, maybe the listeners don't understand, like active dying, what that is all about and how natural that is, and to be able to accept it as an aspect of life. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, the most important thing is they explained to me what actively dying is, what it looks like, and what you're experiencing at that point in time. And she also mentioned another thing that was really, really important to me.
Go ahead.
And that is some parents don't like sometimes their siblings, when they're really, really close, to watch them pass away, because she was just warning me about this. And what was really funny is the very last day that I was with my mother, I was always honest with my mom, and I told her, Mom, you'll have to excuse me because this sounds kind of funny, but I said, Ma, I really got to go to the bathroom. I'll be right back. And by the time I came back, and it was just moments, she had already passed.
Mm-hmm.
But having to understand that active dying really, really, really helped me settle my soul.
Yeah.
And we are also a spiritual family, too, so we also have that in our background, and that helps us out a lot.
And Jude, I'll share that actually when my mother passed away, the time that she actually passed was a very small window when no one was in the room with her. And that was very much in keeping with kind of, you know, her being a fairly solitary person. So thank you so much for sharing that, Jude. And Jackie, I want to ask you if you could briefly just explain for all of us what active dying is.
Right. Well, active dying is really just one stage of the dying process. And usually it's the point at which we realize the person is dying. Now, we may look back and say 3 days ago, yes, they were having some visions of loved ones that were dying, and, you know, and it all makes sense then. But but it's really the moment when you say, okay, I think our days, we're down to days and hours. And so, you know, the person is likely to be in and out of consciousness. They may be seeing loved ones and speaking with loved ones who've passed away. There's this near-death awareness that can be just the most amazing and beautiful thing if someone's there to explain it and not to have it be so frightening. There's physical changes, and it helps so much if you know sort of what to watch for. Their breathing is going to become irregular. There's going to be pauses in the breathing. Sometimes, often, there's a rattle in the back of the throat. What is that? What are we going to do to prevent that? And, you know, is it hurting the person? Pointing out that, you know, this is a normal time when we would stop eating and drinking and, you know, and sort of pointing out the benefits of following the body's natural inclinations, meaning that you don't overload the body with extra fluids that it has to manage as it goes through the process.
I want to make sure we get to at least one more caller, and Mary is in Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hi, I wanted to tell Jackie this story. I only caught the first part of your information, but I'm a medical social worker, and my husband was in hospice and took a very bad turn for the worse and wasn't medically managed very well, and there was a rift in my family, and I was the only person taking care of him. There was no other family on any side involved. And on the day that he died, he needed, like, IV morphine. He was suffocating, obviously, but he needed IV morphine. It was 90 degrees out like it is now. I had no hospice help, and I know about death because I'm a medical social worker. I dealt with that in the hospital. I sub hospice all the time. But I needed somebody for me to talk to me.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I'm so sorry.
Mary, thank you so much for sharing that. And Jackie, I want to make sure that we do get to touch on this. Mary said very eloquently, even though this is more or less her field, she could have used help. She needed help. And, you know, we talked about the fact that there aren't that many death doulas around yet. They might be not be in the area where a family is. Are there elements of what you do, Jackie, that any of us could take on to ease our loved one's transition?
Yes. I mean, I think realizing that just because you're a medical person, when it's your loved one that's dying, you do need that help. And then sort of asking for it and maybe planning ahead. Who are some close friends who I could call when I need that time? What is my community? If it's not my family, what is my chosen community to bring around me in those times? But certainly, I guess the biggest thing would be just asking for help. You know, if that hospice isn't doing it, call another one. But recognizing that you can't do it all yourself and survive is really important.
What's the one most important type of support that you feel that you're able to give, especially the person who is passing out of this life?
I think giving them my calm presence so that their loved ones can just settle in and grieve maybe gives them a little bit of peace and ability to just pass without having to worry so much about their family. So I'm there for the person, just like the caller said, the mother is always a mother, always worrying about her children, and so maybe waits till they leave the room. But just knowing I'm there to take care of the family, I think helps the person pass more peacefully.
And if someone would like to find out if there is a death doula in their area, what would you recommend is the best way to do that?
Well, right now, there isn't one single clearinghouse, so I would just Google that, death doula, and your area, and see what happens. I know some doulas will travel, and I've even considered incorporating some kind of coaching over the phone for families that live far from me, but I know there's three or four different people working in the Madison and Milwaukee areas.
And you also said that some hospice programs are training volunteers who can provide similar services, if not exactly calling it death doulas.
Yes, or they may provide something called death doulas that looks a lot less intensive than what I do. So you really have to check out what they mean by that term.
Well, Jackie, thank you so much for joining us today. Dr. Jackie Yeager is board certified in the specialties of family medicine and hospice and palliative care. She's also a certified death doula and provides intensive bedside support for dying patients and their families. During January's State of the State address, Governor Walker announced that many Wisconsin parents would be eligible to receive a $100 credit per child. He said that it could have a big impact on families around the state.
It could be a new pair of shoes, a winter coat, activity fees at school, or maybe a copay at the doctor or the dentist office. We know sometimes Wisconsin families face challenges when making ends meet, and this new child tax credit, well, we think it can help.
Enrollment started on May 15th, and today is the last day to apply. You can get started by going to childtaxrebate.wi.gov, that's G-O-V, or if you don't have access to the internet, you can call 608-266-5437 to sign up. That's 608-266-KIDS. The basics are that each child under 18 gives a parent the $100 credit, but there are more details available online, and you'll need some info about yourself and also about your child. So if you've got minor kids who you can claim as dependents, remember that today at midnight is the deadline to apply. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll take a look at what the election of a far-left president in Mexico means for Donald Trump, the U.S., and for NAFTA. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.